Good evening. Good evening. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting, I'm Paul LeClaire, the president of this wonderful library, and I'm delighted on behalf of Katie Marin, the wonderful chairman of our Board of Trustees, and all of our trustees, many of whom are here tonight, as well as the extraordinary co-chairs of the President's Council of the New York Public Library, Louise Grinwald, David Steinberg, Alice Tisch. On all of our behalf, I'm really, really happy that you're here this evening at the library in the Celeste Bartos Educational Center for what's going to be another wonderful, wonderful program, the first in our calendar year this year of a conversation and then a dinner at the New York Public Library. Since our last dinner, let me just give you a couple of highlights of some of the things that have been happening. Since our last dinner, we've acquired three hugely, hugely important archival collections for our research libraries. We acquired, for example, the publisher's archive of the New York Times, thanks to, in part, our friend Barbara Goldsmith. This archive consists of 650 linear feet of files and correspondence from the inception of the New York Times in 1851 until the present. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of documents consist of this archive, and it's going to be an immensely important resource for historians and scholars and students for decades and decades and decades to come. We also acquired the archive of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., 250 linear feet of personal papers, diaries, correspondence, and drafts of his works, his books, another vastly important archive that documents the workings of government in a way that I think few historians have ever been able to do, because as opposed to every other historian I can think of, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. was there in the center of an enormously important administration and an eyewitness to some of the most important events that took place during the presidency of John Kennedy Jr. And thanks to the help of Louise Grinwald, we've been able to acquire as well for the Library for the Performing Arts the theater archive of Katharine Hepburn, containing 30 linear feet of memorabilia, correspondence, prompt books. We even have the notebook that she used to practice her speech with, and it has Spencer Tracy's initials on the book. So great, great things continue to come into the library, and part of our strategy for the future is going to be to continue to build very, very aggressively are collections of unique materials, one-of-a-kind things that no one else has, which will be here for everyone to see completely for free, as is everything else at the New York Public Library, thanks in very large part to special friends like you all in the President's Council. And also, since our last dinner, we've come up with a truly encouraging statistic that to many people will be counterintuitive. But would you believe it that in any given calendar year, more people visit public libraries in New York City then visit all of the cultural institutions and all the sports teams combined. Combined. In the last year, thank you. In the last year for which we have statistics, which is 2006, 36 million visits to public libraries in New York City, 34 million visits to cultural organizations and sports teams. And we know that the people who use libraries and visit libraries are basically New Yorkers. So if you care about an organization that is really building the human capital, the cultural capital, and the intellectual capital of New York City, it's the library. There's no better place to be involved and no better place to support. And all of us who labor here lovingly and gladly are deeply, deeply appreciative to what our friends in the President's Council do for us on a daily basis to make our work better and put us in a far better position to serve this vast and important public. Our program tonight is devoted to music in the 20th century. And I'm happy to say that the library's music division, housed at our Library for the Performing Arts, is one of the greatest music collections in the world. It contains more than 2.5 million items, and it documents music in all of its forms and over vast expanses of time. Opera, jazz, spirituals, ragtime, folk, salsa, hip-hop, everything is represented. The music division's curator, George Bozowick, George, are you here? Oh, I hope he'll be here a little later. George and his other curators within the music division have been aggressively collecting the works of contemporary composers, and George has selected a few items for you to see this evening. If you didn't happen to see them on the level that you came into the building at Astor Hall, please stop for a moment and look at the display case that's there, because we have three original scores out for you to see, one by John Cage, which hardly looks like music at all, one by Aaron Copland, and one by Igor Stravinsky, three of the most influential composers of the 20th century, and we're proud to have those manuscripts and hundreds, if not thousands of others, for everyone to use at the Library for the Performing Arts. I'd also like to point out that we're videotaping tonight's program, and we will make it available online for all of our President's Council members who couldn't be here this evening, and really for everybody else around the world. This is part of our new strategy of taking the library's events, its public programs, and its exhibits, and mounting them online for free use all the way around the world. And now it is my very great pleasure to introduce tonight's two special guests, Alex Ross and John Schaefer. Alex Ross has been a music critic for the New Yorker since 1996. His best-selling book, The Rest is Noise, was named one of the top 10 books of 2007 by the New York Times, a very, very rare and special distinction. Mr. Ross's work has been widely recognized, and he has received numerous awards, including a letter of distinction from the American Music Center for significant contributions to the field of contemporary music. John Schaefer, who is joining him and who will be interviewing him or conversing with him, has a voice that's familiar to all of us from being the host of WNYC's music talk show, Soundcheck, which features live performances and interviews with a variety of guests. Mr. Schaefer has also hosted and produced WNYC's radio series, New Sounds, since 1982, and New Sounds Live Concerts, that series, since 1986. Please welcome Alex Ross and John Schaefer to the Celeste Bartos Forum.
Well, thank you all for being here. I'd like to begin, Alex, as you well know, I just got back from North Korea where the New York Philharmonic did a historic concert in Pyongyang, and it certainly has got me thinking in terms of kind of the larger picture that you in the book, The Rest is Noise, cover in some detail, which is the intersection of music and the bigger flow of world events. Now, this is 2008. It didn't take long for classical music to insert itself, or maybe to be inserted is a better way of putting it, into the flow of 21st century history. What gave you the idea of looking at the 20th century, at 20th century history, through the lens of music? What was the light bulb moment that made you think, this could be my way in?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, I feel like I should be interviewing you for the next half hour talking about this incredible experience of being in North Korea, but maybe, you know, dinner we can
only takes one word. Creepy.
Yes.
I'm done.
Because it's particularly fascinating to me because in the book I spend a great deal of time studying what happened to music, the fate of music under these totalitarian regimes in the middle of the 20th century, with particular attention to the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. It's sort of the heart of the book, the dark heart of the book. These great musical traditions of Russia and Germany being absorbed into the politics of Hitler and Stalin, some resisting, others caving in, an incredibly complex story, not of black and white, but of many shades and nuances of gray. And I'm just endlessly fascinated by it because, you know, I love music and I love history. And I took history classes and literature classes in college alongside studying music. And when I started writing this book, I thought of it as, aha, I can just bring all of this together, my passion for music and my passion for history, you know, through the medium of the 20th century, where it's just inescapable. It's inevitable that you're going to end up talking about politics. I think in the 19th century, it's much less obvious. Politics is somewhat to the side of the musical story. I mean, you have Beethoven rejecting Napoleon and various other incidents of Verdi becoming a symbol of the Italian nation. But once you get into the 20th century, it really is unavoidable. You have some composers becoming very explicitly political in their work. Hans Eisler in Germany before Hitler came in writing communist-themed music, fighting songs against the fascists. You have Shostakovich being urged, perhaps forced to write works with a very strong political content in the Soviet Union in the 30s and 40s. And in America, too, voluntarily, you have composers turning to politics and becoming very forceful in that expression. And in a wider way, I think these upheavals, these enormous changes in the political landscape in the 20th century changed how people wrote. And I think these are some of the most interesting questions to get at. You look at the 20th century, and there's such a bewildering diversity of sounds. You have some composers maintaining the romantic, the 19th century traditions. You have others going to avant-garde extremes, as in that John Cage manuscript on display upstairs. You know, why do people make these choices? And I think you find, especially in the middle of the 20th century, there was a sense that the great Western classical tradition had been damaged to some extent by its association with these totalitarian regimes. Certainly many young composers felt that way. And if you think about what it must have been like to be, you know, a young composer in Germany right after 1945, you know, can you even conceive of picking up the thread of Wagner and writing in that mode, you know, given what, you know, a young man like Stockhausen had witnessed and experienced in the last years and months of the World War II, horrible, unimaginable thing. So he couldn't go on. He had to do something quite different. John Cage, who didn't fight in the war, felt something of the same, that music had to turn a new page and go into some new realm. So, you know, in direct ways and indirect ways, politics sort of forced or pushed composers to write in these new ways.
How did this all start? I mean, you know, think of back 100 years, 8 years into the 20th century. I mean, you don't have to be specific to 1908, but, you know, what was going on in the early years of the 20th century that would eventually put music in this position where it would become a kind of a political football in certain parts of the world, ours included?
Right. Well, I start the book with an account of a fascinating event that took place in Graz, the Austrian city of Graz, in 1906. It was the Austrian premiere of Richard Strauss's Salome. Not the world premiere, but the first time it had been performed in Austria. And many musical personalities gathered to see it. Puccini came up from Italy to find out what his German rival was up to. Mahler came down from Vienna. He had wanted very much to present Salome at the Vienna Court Opera, and censors didn't allow him. The young Arnold Schoenberg, who was about to unleash this shocking musical revolution, abandoning tonality, presenting this entirely new language, musical language made up of sharp dissonances. He came from Vienna with no fewer than six of his students. So it was a kind of a class field trip for the second Viennese school, which I discovered by reading the newspapers from Graz that week. You know, they used to list the names of people staying at all the local hotels, so I carefully studied them and found the names of all these Schoenberg students. So, you know, sort of the future and the past and the present, the widow of Johann Strauss was there. And what really intrigued me was this possibility, this rumor that the 17-year-old Adolf Hitler was also present at this event. He later told Strauss's son that he had been there, whether he was actually there or whether he was just trying to impress Richard Strauss for whatever reason, we don't know. There's debate about that. But he claimed to have been there, which is interesting in itself. So you have the sense of this, you know, young man lurking in the background, as he lurked in Vienna in the years that followed behind this fantastic, diverse, uproarious, avant-garde scene, plotting his revenge. And, you know, these shocks and upheavals in music and all the art forms before the First World War, it makes you think of society seething and on the verge of change. And the musical revolutions were, in a way, the most shocking of all. I mean, I find it very interesting to think about why, you know, in the visual arts, once very scandalous paintings by Picasso and Jackson Pollock are now universally famous. They sell for $100 million on the art market. They are, reproduced on placemats and coffee mugs and all this kind of thing. You know, there's no question that it's been assimilated. It's been appropriated by the mainstream. No one goes into a museum and is shocked to find those paintings hanging there. And the musical equivalents, you know, John Cage used to hang out in the Cedar Tavern with Jackson Pollock. He didn't like him very much, but Cage and Morton Feldman, they were associated with these painters, with Rothko and Pollock and de Kooning. They traded, the composers and the painters traded ideas back and forth. It was all one sort of cauldron of innovation. You know, now the painters have gone on to achieve this extraordinary fame, whereas Cage and Feldman are still quite mystifying figures to a lot of people. So why do we find these advances in the visual arts more acceptable, whereas the music remains shocking? I mean, that's something I take up in the book and think about the causes of that.
So, I mean, you know, not just New York in the middle of the century, but Vienna at the turn of the century when, you know,
Kandinsky.
Klimt and Kandinsky are ascendant in the visual arts. And, you know, here's Schoenberg with, you know, young Anton Webern and Alban Berg and apparently a few others in tow. Yeah. And, you know, these guys, I was going to say, couldn't get themselves arrested. They could very easily have gotten themselves arrested.
Right. The police were called to one of Schoenberg's concerts in 1913. There were fights breaking out, as at the Rite of Spring premiere, which happened right around the same time. Something about listening to music. I think it's a very visceral and emotional response we have. I mean, sound is a physical phenomenon. As I speak, there are sound waves moving through the air, and it's touching your bodies. I mean, sound is quite physical that way. So I think our responses are more visceral. And there's also the sense that at a musical performance, it's also a social function, and everyone is trapped in the space for the duration of the work, as all of you are trapped here now. And in a gallery, in a museum, if you see something you don't like, you just sort of turn your head and walk away. And maybe, later that hour, you come back and look at it again, or maybe next year you come back and see that painting and have a different response. But you're on your own sort of timeline with it, whereas in music, we're all forced to listen together. And I think that's why responses were maybe a bit more conservative in the musical arena, and why people still have trouble with this music now. Although not in the movie theater, because all these sounds, you take all these sounds out of the concert hall and you put them on the soundtrack to Psycho, North by Northwest,
absolutely.
Every sci-fi movie ever made, and it becomes integral to the power of the film experience. And no one could make a thriller or a horror movie or a sci-fi movie without Schoenberg and Stravinsky having introduced these chords of unease and of anxiety into the vocabulary. You couldn't have a thriller with Brahms on the soundtrack. I don't think it really wouldn't work.
I guess it depends on how much of a thrill you wanted from your thriller. It's ancient history, but as far back as Plato and Pythagoras, the ancient Greeks, with the idea that music was something you had to be careful with,
right,
that certain tunings and certain scale forms were, you know, would inflame the base emotions and things like that. You know, this was not a new idea, but it seems to have been an idea that really kind of percolated in the 20th century.
Right.
Why? What was the turning point, if there was a single point or a single decade, where things just changed from the 19th century into the 20th?
Well, it did happen very suddenly, I think, though it happened in several stages. I mean, in 1908, 1909, through 1913, there was a whole wave of works written one after another that really emphasized dissonance, new combinations of sounds in Stravinsky and Alban Berg and Webern, Schoenberg, Berg, Webern, and Stravinsky, Scriabin, the early works of Charles Ives. Suddenly let's combine tones in new way and examine what effect they can have. But there was kind of a second wave of modernism, which I find just as important, isn't always talked about as much, which is the sense of composers sort of looking to renovate their language by not by inventing entirely new chords, but say by looking to folk music finding a new sort of very primitive and raw and forceful language by just listening to folk music very carefully, not trying to dress it up and neaten it up for sort of symphonic consumption. And that's what Bartok did and Janáček and the young Stravinsky. And then in the 1920s, there was this engagement with pop music, with jazz and vaudeville, music hall, and the young composers, Les Six, in Paris were doing that, as did Stravinsky in that period. Stravinsky always right there on the front lines of experimentation. And in Germany, too, in Weimar Germany, Kurt Weill. So this was another kind of modernism, very important. And it just sort of escalated. I think by 1930, you just couldn't make any generalizations about what classical music sounded like anymore. I mean, there were people still writing in the Romantic style. There were people imitating jazz. There was this folk-inflected, folkloristic music. There was the highly dissonant music of Schoenberg and his pupils, the ultra-dissonant music of Varèse once he had moved to New York and sort of imitating the sound of grinding machinery
and traffic and
foghorns and sort of the sounds of the city. So it just really complete chaos, a kind of glorious chaos. What happened in the 30s was this very sharp reaction. And I think this is really where politics enters the picture. I mean, Hitler and Stalin were really, sort of aside from everything else you can say about them, they were ordinary music lovers with rather conservative tastes. And their tastes were generalized, were made law, essentially. And so there was an enormous reaction against the more adventurous forms of musical activity. And all really came to a stop in the 1930s. And Shostakovich famously bore the brunt of it when Stalin walked out of a performance of his opera Lady Macbeth in 1936. And 2 days later, the editorial was published in Pravda, calling it muddle instead of music. And Shostakovich, just 3 days before, had been the most celebrated, the most lionized young hero of Soviet music, and suddenly he was plunged into the depths, and he was in a category where his very future was questionable. You know, whether he was going to live or die, never mind whether he would continue to be able to express himself freely. And he remarkably, with great savvy, extricated himself from that situation and went on to, when I think of all the moments at which politics and music collided in the 20th century, I think the single most dramatic moment came when Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony was first performed in Leningrad itself. And the score, Shostakovich had begun writing the symphony there, and then he was evacuated during at the beginning of the 900-day siege of Leningrad by the German forces. He finished the symphony. It was famously conducted by Toscanini on NBC radio. And then the score was flown in. This ragtag orchestra rehearsed it. People were sort of keeling over from starvation, and the rehearsals had to be stopped so that people could go fight on the front lines. But they got the piece together, and it was performed. And loudspeakers were set up in the perimeter of the no man's land, and the music was broadcast to the German soldiers on the other side. And it was an incredibly powerful emblem of the city's refusal to give in, but also a slightly scary moment at which music was literally weaponized. It became a weapon, a very piercing psychological weapon. And supposedly some German soldiers came to Leningrad years later after the war and told their former enemies that when they heard that music coming at them, they knew that Germany was going to lose the war. So that's an extraordinary position, to say the least, for music to be placed in.
And, you know, Shostakovich was an extraordinary character because he never emigrated. I mean, his picture after the Leningrad Symphony, I mean, he graced the cover, I believe, both Time and Newsweek magazine here in the States. He was lionized here as well for his...
Time, at least, yeah. With the fireman's helmet.
But... he somehow, you know, through all the ups and downs, managed to deal with, you know, charges of formalism, which basically meant anything Stalin didn't understand. Prokofiev, on the other hand, you know, going through the same period, living there, you know, sort of had gone to France, was sort of drawn back with promises of, you know, you will be the great composer of the motherland and stuff, and then gets there and absolutely can't deal with this at all. So it's a very dangerous thing, and a lot of these composers found themselves walking a tightrope, and some of them fell off and some of them didn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you look at, we can stick with, you know, the World War II period for the moment. As you look at the effect of this weaponization, the politicalization of music, what was that effect on the composers themselves?
Yeah. I mean, I really resist the temptation to judge these people. I mean, as I was writing the book, I tried to be absolutely as precise as possible about the facts not to sort of jump in and deliver my own judgments and sort of who was sort of the hero and who was the coward and sort of grade people on some kind of scale. I mean, who knows what it was like to live through these situations when Shostakovich at one point was sleeping on a cot in the hallway of his apartment because if the NKVD, if the secret police came, he didn't want his children to see him being dragged from his bedroom and out of the apartment, and many people did that in that period. You know, imagine what Prokofiev must have gone through from sort of, you know, entering as this hero, this man lionized in the West and drawn in with all these promises and treated brutally. He in the end was treated worse than Shostakovich because just time and again he would labor for years his masterpiece War and Peace and other works and anticipate performances that were canceled at the last minute or you know something had to be changed and he never got to see War and Peace played complete and it absolutely broke his heart and he died really a destroyed human being in a lot of ways though he still had this ability to write those wonderful floating Prokofiev melodies right to the end and whereas Shostakovich there was. I think there was some part of Shostakovich that he protected from all this chaos and all this darkness. You know, he perfected the art of saying anything and signing any piece of paper just in order so that he'd be left alone. And you know, whatever you may think about the ethics of behaving in that way, he did preserve that sense of self that enabled him to express himself so strongly. Right up to the end. There's this wonderful story about Shostakovich that Sviatoslav Richter told that they were at a performance of, I think it was the First Symphony, and it was a very bad performance, and a colleague leaned over to Shostakovich and said, I can't believe this is a horrible, can you believe this performance, Dmitri Dmitrievich? And Shostakovich didn't quite hear him right and said, oh, yes, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful performance. And the man, no, terrible, terrible. It's a terrible performance. I can't believe, you know, you can't possibly like this. And Shostakovich says, oh, yes, a terrible performance. I agree. And Richter said, that was Shostakovich to the life.
Well, it kind of has to be.
Make it go away, yeah. You know.
But, you know, we kind of expect that from Stalinist Russia, Nazi Germany with its appropriation of Wagner and that trying to appropriate Beethoven as well. That didn't work out nearly as well just because of the nature of Beethoven and his music. But what about here in the United States? I mean, how did that sort of relationship between government and the composing community work?
Well, it's really interesting. I did quite a bit of research, some here at the New York Public Library and down at the Library of Congress and also the National Archives in Washington. And you can find all the papers connected with the amazing federal music project from the mid-1930s when, you know, the arts were being nationalized in this country. Artists were out of work, and the spirit of the New Deal was that everyone could be employed, including the artists. So musicians went on the payroll. There were dozens of orchestras all across the country, opera houses. They would give performances for free or for very low prices, sort of education projects in cities and towns in Nebraska and Oklahoma and all kinds of places that had never seen orchestras of this type before. An amazing kind of efflorescence of public funded music. And then it all came crashing to an end for a very explicitly political reason. The congressional elections of 1938, Roosevelt lost quite a few supporters, and conservative Democrats banded together with Republicans to roll back the New Deal. And they found one very, very juicy target, the Federal Theater Project, which was guilty of some productions that were socialistic to the point of being outright communistic, and they were also
socialist, but you're talking about a program that sounds like socialism.
Well, yes. Well, let's just say outright, you know, sort of borderline communistic, and also they were putting on performances that were sometimes essentially propaganda for the New Deal for Roosevelt himself, which is a tricky situation to have, you know, publicly funded art supporting a Democratic administration. So some very tricky issues were coming up there. But essentially, just the most, a few egregious examples were singled out and made representative of this entire spectrum of activity, most of which was absolutely apolitical and had no connection with political issues, and it was all sort of condemned on the same basis. A very typical political move that, of course, we've seen time and again in
the Mapplethorpe photos.
Yeah. And but of course, Aaron Copland was a composer who was very much in the spirit of the New Deal and of this strongly leftist artistic mentality that prevailed in so many circles in the 1930s. And the manuscript up here is Five Kings. I believe this was the only occasion on which Copland collaborated with Orson Welles. And Orson Welles, of course, was, you know, first made his name in the late 30s against the backdrop of the New Deal and the Popular Front. So it's a very interesting to sort of glimpse those two artists coming into contact for a moment or two. And you know, Copland was quite political in those years, and then edged away from it. But he still paid the price. He was called before Joseph McCarthy's committee and interrogated in a private hearing about his political connections. Lincoln Portrait was supposed to be played at a concert around the time of Eisenhower's first inauguration, and it was taken off the program when anti-communist congressmen started reading aloud Copland's political associations into the congressional record, and the Lincoln Portrait was taken off the program in the end. That's a fascinating tale of a composer being tangled up in politics in various ways, paying some consequences. And yet, of course, this was a very different situation from the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, and Copland could, at the end of the day, walk away from it. And ironically, toward the end of his life, you know, you find when Reagan was running for re-election in 1984, there was the Morning in America campaign, and there was this campaign film that was played at the convention. The fields, corn and wheat and sort of farmers on tractors and newsboys throwing newspapers and old people on their porches reading newspapers, all that kind of thing. And the music was pure Aaron Copland, sort of ersatz Copland playing on the soundtrack. And you're guaranteed, whenever you see a scene in a movie with the rolling corn fields and sort of the American heartland, you're going to be hearing Copland-esque, perfect fifths and
right.
Sort of, you know, open interval melodies in the sound.
The irony being this kind of, you know, iconic sonic imagery of the wide open West coming from a guy who was born and raised in Brooklyn.
Right, yeah.
And really hadn't had much experience with the wide open spaces
right.
of the Midwest.
He'd really never been there when he wrote all that.
But he did, he was sort of akin to Béla Bartók and Janáček and Kodály and all these other composers
yeah.
that you mentioned before who went tramping around, you know, trying to, I mean, it was sort of a part and parcel of the rise of nationalism at the end of the 19th century. It's Sibelius in Finland and Verdi in Italy, as you mentioned, and Copland sort of doing the same thing. And he, I guess he identified that sound, those open fifths, yeah. as the sounds of American traditional fiddle music.
But there's something more fundamental going on. And once you look past all the politics and the schools of composers competing against each other and the atonalists versus the neoclassicists versus the folklorists and so on, if you really step back and look at all this activity, I think you find so many of these composers looking for the same thing in very different ways. They had all, many of them had grown up with sort of classical music as it's so commonly defined, this the repertory going from Haydn to Mozart, from Haydn and Mozart to sort of Brahms and Wagner. And then they had been exposed to that music early on. And then they wanted to find their own language, you know, a contemporary language, 20th century language, an American language, or a Hungarian language, or a sort of, you know, young person in Paris in the 20s language. And so the idea was just to find a music, a vocabulary that was real in a sense, that was sort of the moment. And I think there were so many different responses, just kind of impossibly varied, diverse responses to that challenge. But they were all seeking the same thing, which is why, I mean, when I look back on this whole century of music, I find it so thrilling in a way to see this diversity of responses, these imaginative leaps in all different directions as composers simply struggled to escape the past in a way, this monumental past, you know, Beethoven's bust staring at you from the piano. And, you know, how do you get away from that? At the same time, how do you learn from that? Because, you know, so many of those composers had studied this music very carefully. Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony is a profoundly Beethovenian work. It couldn't possibly exist without Beethoven's example. But then to sort of to make it your own, to make it of the moment, that's the ongoing struggle.
So as we, you know, are in the first decade of the 21st century and you look ahead, we have a number of younger composers who seem to be doing the same thing now with popular music, whether mm-hmm. that's, you know, rock or electronics or whatever. Are they doing the same thing that this earlier generation of composers was doing and looking for the kind of the populist, the rooted music of
I think so. It's certainly a trend among some composers. You know, they've grown up with, well, I think, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, you had young composers coming to the fore who had grown up with rock and maybe a little earlier with bebop jazz. When you listen to the minimalist composers, sort of classic pieces by Steve Reich and Philip Glass, there's this driving beat, there's this sort of cruising energy, I think, that definitely shares something with rock and roll. So now you have composers who've grown up with hip-hop, with kind of, you know, electronic dance music, with just the whole sort of incredible diversity of, you know, pop music. I mean, when we say pop music, we're talking about a sort of, you know, dozens upon dozens of genres and subgenres and subcultures and a whole world of music there. So there's so much to choose from, you know. But you know, all along, this is what classical composers have done. I think composing, in the end, is a kind of a feeding off of the music that's already out there. It's not a language in and of itself, separate from the whole rest of music and the whole rest of culture. I mean, if you look at how Mozart composed. I mean, he was taking something from sort of, you know, Italian aria sort of opera tradition, something from sort of German singspiel tradition and folk tunes and sort of all the dances of the day. He was just kind of parasitically feeding off of it and then making it, you know, so unmistakably his own. But he wasn't inventing music out of thin air. And so sort of, you know, decade after decade, century after century, composers are reacting to the music that's there. So I don't feel that there's a crisp border between classical music and all this other kind of music. I think the composers are people who are just looking over this entire huge terrain and, you know, hearing something here which they're going to take, sort of ignoring, you know, something else, and just sort of assembling their own musical worldview. And I think it's really vital what young composers just in their 20s are doing right now. It's really alive.
Well, with that image of Mozart as a musical leech, I think we'll send you all upstairs for dinner. Alex Ross, thank you very much. Thank you.